Hello and welcome to this week's History Quine podcast with me, Fiona Jane Brown. Now, we're going to do a follow-on story today, another true crime, that of Harry Burnett. Harry Burnett was the man that was the last to be hanged in Scotland at our own Craigenshaws prison here in Aberdeen. It was a sensation at the time. This case was remembered because of the way the victim's wife was treated. The victim was one Tommy Guyon that Harry shot because he was having an affair with Tommy's wife, Margaret. And as far as the judge was concerned, she was no victim. She was described as a femme fatale. So let's have a look at this case. Now, the crime took place on the 31st of May 1963 at 14 Jackson Terrace, Aberdeen. That's off Hurt Road. And it actually lies on an old right-of-way from the city to the gallows. Really, you can't miss the irony of that. So, in the middle of the morning on the 31st of May 1963, Harry Burnett burst into the home of his girlfriend, Margaret Guyon's grandmother, and Harry shot dead Tommy Guyon point blank with a shotgun he'd actually pinched from his brother Frank. In fact, he'd actually gone to Frank's house and pushed past his sister-in-law and broken open Frank's gun cabinet and taken a sawn-off shotgun that he knew how to use, ironically, because his brother had taught him to use it for shooting vermin up at Scotston Moor. He and Frank used to shoot crows and pigeons. He bursts in, and there are quite a few people there that see this happen. I've actually seen the crime scene photos from when I was police curator. It's really quite stark. The black and white images of Tommy lying in the living room just beside the door, and he has no face. It was point blank. His face was absolutely destroyed. Margaret screamed at everybody to be quiet and said to Harry, "Don't hurt anybody else, I'll go with you." So he pulls Margaret with him. They go out the house and try to escape by stealing a car from a garage just up the road at Seaforth Road. However, they didn't get very far. They were out on the Ellen Road when the police caught up with them. Now, there was a very strange conversation had happened in this car. Margaret had agreed to marry Harry because he'd said to her, "Well now, Margaret, you're a widow. Will you marry me?" And she agreed. Let's look a bit further into why Harry did what he did. Now, the man that he killed, Tommy Guyon, was a merchant seaman. That's why Harry and Margaret were able to have their affair, because Tommy was never there. His family were from Torry. I found out from looking into the records that he, his father, his brothers and uncle had all been in trouble with the law for violent offences. In fact, his father and brothers had actually served time in Craigenshaws. So he was quite a tough guy, but faced with a shotgun and no chance to sort of defend himself, there was not much he could do. But Tommy seems to have been the kind of man that, although he came from a tough family, he was a moral man as well. When he married Margaret, I am sure he completely meant his vows, till death do us part. But little did he know that he was predicting his own death when he repeated that vow. So let's look at Harry. Harry is the name that he's known by, but his official name was Henry John Burnett Jr. His father was Henry John. He was born in the parish of Pitsligo at a wee farm near Rosehearty. He was actually born within the site of Rosehearty's Gallows Hill. Again, it just seems that this Peer Loon was cursed from the off. So he was born in the countryside, but very soon the family moved in to Aberdeen and lived at a tenement in Powys Circle. There was a big family, and his father, Henry Sr., worked with the hydro schemes and the forestry departments. So again, he too was not often there. Harry's mum, Matilda, said that Harry had been a normal and easy child until he was 13. He did an accident. He tripped in the tram lines in Broad Street and been hit by a bus, and he'd broken his leg, and he'd spent nearly 3 months in hospital. And when he came out, he was a different Harry altogether. He spent most of his teens getting charged for assault against his younger sisters and his mother. He was fine when his dad was there, but he just seemed to get an absolute hatred of women, or hatred of maternal authority, I don't know. But really, he had a vicious temper, and Matilda had noticed the change in him. It wasn't just his temper. His educational ability had been affected by this, because when he was 15, he was tested by the educational authorities, and his certain educational ability was that of a 12-year-old, so he wasn't progressing. It seems that he was stuck at that 13-year-old. You could say that he wasn't normal, not our kind of normal. So he and Margaret actually met while he was working at John Stevens' fish processing yard in Torrey. Now, he'd gone through a series of jobs after leaving school. He had actually ended up at the equivalent of a borstal. It was a working farm down in Fife, and he had been put there till he was 18 by his probation officer, a Welsh guy, a Taffy Thomas. Taffy was his nickname. And Harry seemed to get on with Taffy, and according to the letters that Taffy wrote to Harry while he was at the farm, he was encouraging him, look, Harry, you've got to take responsibility once you're 18, you've got to get a proper job. So he did try. Honestly, he tried. His father got him work with the Forestry Commission up in Inverness. Within a month, he'd been sacked and been accused of making a local girl pregnant. Then his brother-in-law said, well, look, come to sea with us. One of his sisters had married a fisherman from Fraserburgh, and Harry was like, yeah. He really enjoyed being in male company, but he didn't stick. He just didn't seem to have an ability to concentrate on anything for very long. So this was about his fourth or fifth job, this at the fish yard. When he met Margaret, he wasn't to know that she already had one illegitimate child, Keith, who was born in 1961. Her first son, Charles, was Tommy's child. He was born in 1958. Margaret had already asked for a divorce, but here's evidence of Tommy's moralistic attitude. He said, nah, you're not leaving. I'll bring the bairn up as mine, but behave yourself. So looking now, the story that I was told by John Mayer, who was a police constable at the time, and he actually attended Harry at the court case at the murder trial. And Harry told him, seems to have told him an awful lot of stuff. And one of the things was this first meeting with Margaret, that he was standing in the queue at the fish yard office to get his wages, and Margaret, working in the office there, she was handing out the pay packets. He was boasting to his mates about his wee black book. Again, he was spoiled for choice as to what girl he was going to ask out to the dancing that weekend. And Margaret apparently fluttered her eyelashes at him and said, Harry, if you come out with me tonight, you won't need to go home. Well, that was enough for a lusty young 20-year-old. That was it. That was like sex on a plate, really, not putting too fine a point in it. So, of course, he jumped headlong into this affair. Now, it just shows you what kind of person Margaret was as well. She had a friend who had a flat in Skene Terrace. So she and Harry and little Keith, who would have been no more than a toddler at the time, moved into this flat. Her grandmother, knowing what was going on, she did warn Harry to stay away from Margaret. She knew what her granddaughter was like, and she said to him, Harry, she's no good for you. And it's almost like everything was pointing to this ending up in a complete disaster. When Harry had shot Tommy, as I say, his face was completely destroyed by the gunshot wound. He'd shot two shells from a double barrel shotgun. Now, I've actually held this gun. We have it, or we had it, I should say, in the police museum collection because it was an important historical case. And it didn't have a firing pin, so it had been disabled. But as far as I know, that gun still resides with the gunsmith in Inverurie. He's got it because it was supposed to go down to Birmingham to get a certificate to say that it was completely disabled and couldn't be used for any firing purposes. So as far as I know, Rod Stone, you've still got the gun. Anyway, the gun belonged to Frank, Harry's older brother, and he'd stolen it despite protests from his sister-in-law. So back to the murder scene. This is really quite horrific. What had happened? Harry had banged on the door and it had been opened by Gina Catanach, who was Margaret's granny's pal. And Gina was already aware of Harry because she'd encountered him when Margaret was making a bid to go back to Tommy. And Margaret and Harry had had a fight and Gina had shouted at Harry, "She's not getting a divorce." And of course, this had tipped him right over the edge. Anyway, Gina opens the door. Harry pushes past her. Tommy comes to see what's going on. And he's just about to say something to Harry when bang, bang. Not only is Tommy killed, but a fragment of shot pings off and actually hits Margaret's granny, Annie Henderson. So she's injured. Little boy Keith, who's a toddler, as I say, who's only two. Charles, he's five or six. The Bairns have seen their father shot dead. And it really, I mean, I can't imagine how horrible that was. And the screaming and the noise was enough to obviously get the rest of the property in an uproar as well. So when Harry and Margaret left the tenement, their upstairs neighbour, David Cousins, who lived with his grandparents in the next flat, actually had obviously heard the shots. And when Harry and Margaret came out of the door, David was like, "What's happened? I heard a gun." And Harry points the empty gun at David and he's scared, obviously. So they leave and David dashes to the nearest phone box to call the police. So, Harry and Margaret, they're running up Ochert Lane. Ochert Lane is that road that I mentioned, which is part of the old right-of-way from the Tolbooth all the way to Gallows Hill at the top of Earl Street. Used to be a garage at the top of Ochert Lane and Seaforth Road, and there's a guy called John Irvin. He had just finished filling his car up with petrol, and he again, looks round, Harry pointing the gun at him. Now, remember, at this point, the gun is actually empty, but you're not going to argue with somebody that's pointing a gun in your face. And he had said, I'll have those keys now. And the two of them disappeared. Now, David Cousins, meanwhile, has managed to get had of a police officer. Sergeant Davidson is the first person to reach 14 Jackson Terrace. And Gina and Annie are screaming their heads off and Tommy's lying there on the floor dead. And the presiding inspector, Harry Halcrow, who eventually was promoted to detective chief inspector, once they got a hold of Harry, and it said that when Harry was arrested, he was fine because he'd got what he wanted. He'd got Margaret to agree to marry him. Harry Halcrow indicted Harry Burnett for murder and aye, he must be dead. I gave him both barrels. And again, that was John Mayer that witnessed that being said. Also, amongst the crime scene photographs are pictures of Margaret showing the injury to her neck, which Harry had given her earlier on in the day when they'd had a fight at Skene Terrace. And he'd actually threatened her with a knife and it had nicked her neck. And he'd pushed her to the ground and she'd fallen, and he thought that he'd really done her serious damage. Now, considering that he actually believed she was pregnant with his child, it just shows you that he really wasn't in his right mind. His rages were absolutely uncontrollable, and that was the excuse that Margaret was given to leave him, to go back to her granny's to have her child or their child. Now, there's no evidence that we know of that this was true, but certainly Margaret had him, Harry, convinced that she was going to have his baby. And whether she lost it then or lost it because she tried to take an overdose after the death sentence was pronounced on Harry, we'll probably never know unless somebody gets access to her medical notes. So the trial takes place and Lord Wheatley was the presiding judge. And he had said to the jury, the issue's not whether Harry's a murderer, but what was his state of mind at the time of the murder? Because defence lawyers tried to put forward a defence of insanity, and Harry himself didn't even want that to happen. Harry's lawyers had already got information from Ian Lewitt. Dr. Ian Lewitt was a child psychologist who had met Harry once before. When Harry himself had taken an overdose when he was 18, he'd landed up in King's Seat, and that's when Dr. Lewitt had first met him and had tried to help him. And he, Dr. Lewitt, was asked to be an expert witness to support the defence plea of insanity or at least diminished responsibility. Now, Dr. Lewitt got his colleague from Glasgow University, Dr. John Gaylor, to help him. They'd actually taken Harry up to Forrester Hill and done an EEG trace on Harry's brain. And they discovered, firstly, that the EEG trace, and again, I've actually seen that because it's in the records in the National Records of Scotland in Edinburgh. The trace showed that Harry's brain had abnormal electrical activity. Also, when they x-rayed his brain, and again, I don't know how they managed to do this because they didn't have MRI or anything in those days. They'd been able to tell, anyway, from a scan of his brain that the right side of it, the physical brain, was atrophied or shrunken. And the two doctors speculated either this happened at birth or before birth, if his mother Matilda had been ill during her pregnancy. But I think it's more likely that that happened when he had his accident when he was 13. His brain just stopped developing physically and mentally. This was Dr. Lewitt's assessment of Harry. Now, we've got to remember, he was recently qualified. He was relying on Dr. Gaylor to back him up. This is how he described Harry: as a person of psychopathic or extremely immature personality, and in that respect may be regarded as not fully responsible for his behaviour. The definition of psychopath had only been arrived at in 1959, which was part of the Mental Health Act in that year. Psychopathy really could only be treated at that time by chlorpromazine, which is a really strong sedative, and probably Harry would have not wanted to take anything like that. As well, as I say, he was first sent away to a borstal when he was 15 because he'd thrown a chair at his mother and threatened his sister with a knife. And as I say, Taffy Thomas, his probation officer, had said that what Harry lacked in his life was a strong father figure. His dad was away working, and really, it's quite tragic that that was the case. So Lord Wheatley turns to Dr. Lewitt and said, "What do you mean by psychopathic personality?" And Dr. Lewitt replied and says that this abnormal activity in Harry's brain could result in violent behaviour outside of the volitional pattern of normal living, i.e. Harry couldn't control his temper. Now, Harry's father said that Harry went kind of mad, that's a quote, when he lost his temper. So psychopathy, we think today that we all know about psychopaths, that they have no empathy and that they're cold, calculating killers. Harry's the opposite. He's an angry young man. So I don't think, according to present knowledge of mental health, that Harry would have been described as a psychopath. More likely, something else, some other neurological issue was in evidence there. Lord Whateley, however, as far as he was concerned, Harry had committed this murder with malice aforethought. He had planned it by going to get the gun after he'd left Margaret at Skene Terrace. So Lord Whateley said, "I can find nothing in his, Harry's past that gives me room for reasonable doubt that Burnet was other than his normal self when he shot Guyon. I personally think that Harry's normal was clearly not the same as everyone else's, because a 20-year-old man does not normally go off on one at the least provocation, especially when he was sober as well." So as far as Lord Whateley was concerned, this was a murder that carried the death penalty. So the jury were fairly convinced by that, because sadly, they only took half an hour to reach their decision. They found Harry guilty of assaulting Margaret when he'd left her at Skene Terrace, and guilty of murder by a majority verdict of 13-2. 13-2. Yes, of course Harry committed the murder, but this is the point, that as he, that was said, that wasn't the issue. It was whether he knew what he was doing. And quite a lot of people today think he didn't know what he was doing. Lord Whateley had words for Margaret Guyon, though. He said that she was an immoral woman, unable to resist the influence of whichever the two men, husband or lover, she was with at the time. She had told Harry she was pregnant by him, but she'd gone to see Tommy that very day and confessed to him what she'd done, and Tommy had taken her back. He'd already taken her once when she'd been pregnant with another man's child. So again, she was just relying on, "Oh, good old Tommy, he'll take me back." So I just wonder who was the most abusive personality here. She told the police that it was Harry she really loved, that Tommy was a good father to the bairns, but he wasn't a husband. He was never at home, never looking after her. And she probably would have left Tommy again very soon. When the guilty verdict was pronounced, Harry's sister Mary screamed out, "It's her that should have been in the dock," at Margaret, because obviously she thought it was Margaret's fault that Harry had lost the rag and killed Tommy. Lord Whateley's final statement before delivering the death sentence: "It will not suffice in law for the purpose of this defence of diminished responsibility, merely to show that an accused person has a very short temper or is unusually excitable and lacking in self-control. The world would be a very convenient place for criminals and a very dangerous place for other people if that were the law." So, the date for execution was set to the 15th of August, 1963, and Mary screamed, "Oh no, 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 they can't do that to him!" John Mayer, the constable that was accompanying Harry in the dock, he had turned to John and looked at him incredulously and said, "They're not going to hang me, are they?" And John, being a kindly manny, had said, "No, no, no, you'll get an appeal." Harry's lawyer put in a request for an appeal, but Harry said, "Nah, no, I know what I've done. I've committed a crime. In fact," he said, "I want to die and get it all over with. However, I didn't stop 3,000 people, including the Provost of Aberdeen, putting a petition to the Scottish Secretary to not overturn the sentence, but to reduce the sentence to life imprisonment." On the 7th of that month, the Home Office in London, the Home Secretary, put a suggestion to Lord Whateley that they would give a hesitant reprieve in view of the medical reports. The Scottish Secretary actually backed him up as well, the Home Secretary at the time. It was up to Lord Whateley. It was a suggestion because, of course, this is Scots law. The Home Secretary, representing English law, couldn't actually force Lord Whateley to do anything. So the judge kept to his sentence and would not change it. On the 8th, The following day, of course, Margaret Guyon hears this. She attempts to kill herself, the sectioner, and take her to King's Seat. Harry begs his lawyer to let him see her because he was locked up, he couldn't be with her, and of course he knew that she was pregnant. What seems to have happened then is that Harry seems to have completely accepted that he was going to die and that that was it. And there is actually, I don't know if it's still online, but there was a whole blog which had the information from the prison warden's day book. They actually had to, there were two wardens who would sit with Harry every day. Basically, they were keeping an eye on him, make sure that he didn't kill himself before the actual execution date. They had to observe his behaviour and they wrote it up. Before I knew about this blog, I actually saw this information down at the National Archives as well. And Harry's behaviour, again, it was odd. He was cheery, he was sarcastic about death and as if it didn't matter. He was visited every week by both Canon Glennie, who was the rector of the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Torrey, and Reverend Dixon, who was the prison chaplain. And he was actually the minister of Torrey St. Fiddick's as well, I believe. And he played cards with them. Reverend Dixon would later note that Harry really had a childish understanding of the world. He didn't understand anything about God, about religion, at a time when all children were put to Sunday school. Harry just didn't get it. Harry had accepted that, but again, like the young pubescent teenager whose mental age he represented, he really didn't get it. He was like a second year at academy level. Just think about that. This is a 21-year-old man that's committed a murder that's going to end up in his own death. This is an example. He said to John Mayer that shooting Tommy was like shooting a bird. He knew that murder was wrong, but the morality of it, he didn't seem to understand that. As far as he was concerned, he'd broken a rule and he was going to suffer for it. Now, what's really touching are the letters that Harry wrote on the night before his execution. He wrote one to the governor of the prison, hoping that the governor would pass it on to the Daily Record. Obviously, they weren't going to publish that, but that letter exists. I've seen it. Standout line is what Harry writes. And again, this scrawly, early teenage writing, this is a guy who, he was not a man. He was a child, certainly in his mind. He wrote, "But as far as blame goes, there was only one person to blame, and that was me." He was upset that Margaret was getting a bad press. As I say, the fact that she'd taken an overdose, I think that's probably when she'd maybe lost the baby. Then he writes this just so sweet letter to Margaret. He'd actually seen her on the day, earlier that day, and he'd said, "Tell her, dinna hurt yourself again," because she had to live to look after her children, Keith and Charles. And this is what he wrote. "My darling Meg, I will never see you again, but don't forget I have never loved anyone as much as I loved you, which was more than life." He said he would miss the boys, her boys, and he said he would love them as much as he could have done their own darling, his and Margaret's baby. So she must have told them that the baby had been lost. Now, it's actually quite intriguing, the day of the execution, the 15th of August 1963. The warden said that usually when there'd been, in the old East prison, when there'd been an execution, there was a heap of noise before it took place. But this was the first and only execution taking place at Craiginch's. And they said it was just silent because what the prisoners liked Harry. They were sympathetic to him. They were like, "Ah, gee, this has happened to you because of some quine. This is really rotten. they, as hardened criminals, realised, hey, this guy shouldn't be here. And 8 o'clock in the morning is the time of the execution. Probably a couple of hours before that, Harry's woken up. Apparently, the warden who came in offered him a dram of whiskey. And Harry was like, nah, 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 I'm not having that. Because he thought it was either poisoned or had a sedative in it, because he was convinced he'd been given a sedative the night before. The warden gave him a cup of tea and told him what was going to happen. The governor, one of the detective inspectors from Queen Street Lodge Walk, was going to come there as well, and there would also be the two wardens and Reverend Dixon, who also came and saw Harry and prayed with him that morning. In fact, Canon Glennie, the Catholic rector, was there also, but he stayed at the execution cell and prayed. So they all troop across to the execution suite, and waiting for them, Harry Allen, the executioner. The two men shook hands, and Harry Allen assured Harry Burnett it's not going to take long. And so he gets Harry to come and stand on the trapdoor. By this time, Harry's arms are being pinioned behind him by Harry Allen's assistant. And just before the hood's put over Harry's eyes, and they still did this. This is something that they used to do when executions were public, but they still did it because for some odd reason, they wanted to spare the observers the sight of a person strangling to death. But by the time we get to 1963, hanging is a science. Overnight, once Harry Allen had got Harry Burnett's details, his height and weight, he would have actually set up the rope on the gallows, and he would have suspended a bag of flour, I think it was, they used flour or earth, suspend it on the rope, and the bag was the weight of the prisoner, and it stretched the rope, so the rope would have enough springiness to actually pull Harry down through the trapdoor and snap his neck. It's, I think it's a C1 or C2 vertebrae that it snaps, that kills the brainstem. From when Harry walked out of the execution cell to standing on the platform, that was a couple of seconds. He took 20 seconds to die. And the last thing that Harry saw was Reverend Glennie holding out a crucifix in front of him. That's included in Norman Adams's account of the case in Blood and Granite. And Reverend Dixon said that Harry died like a soldier, that he was a good lad, and he wasn't frightened at the very end. So, I mean, for all of that, it's absolutely tragic, considering that we've also had a couple of years before that, I think 5 years before, there was a man who was convicted of killing his partner's baby, and the execution suite was actually built for him, but his sentence was reduced to life imprisonment because they couldn't find the baby's body. It's fairly likely that that man was in the prison and knew that those gallows had been meant for him, but Harry was going to be the one and only one that was hanged in Craiginches, which had opened in 1891. There'd not been another hanging in Aberdeen since 1857, which was actually the last hanging down at the Old East Prison, which is where police headquarters are today. It was quick. That was it, or so you would have thought. But no, that was not it. The sympathy for Harry in the press was extremely strong. They argued he shouldn't have been hanged, that death penalty was under review, and that because of his mental issues, he should have been, had his sentence commuted to life imprisonment. Even Tommy Guyon's mother herself commented that killing Harry wouldn't bring Tommy back. And she'd actually said how awful she'd felt for Matilda Burnett. She even signed the petition for Harry's reprieve. And she said to the press, "I can find it in my heart to forgive Henry Burnet. It's his mother I'm sorry for. I don't think Henry Burnet should hang." Even Tommy's brother, John Guyon, said there was something wrong with Harry. So again, he wasn't in his right mind, according to them. Certainly, recent research shows that people that suffered from the same issue as Harry, this what they called cerebral atrophy, patients suffering from right brain atrophy exhibited a variety of behavioural symptoms, including social disinhibition, depression and aggressive behaviour. So again, it's not psychopathy, it's a completely out of control temper. And it's almost like they're describing bipolar disorder, this social inhibition side of it. So again, I'm not sure. Psychiatrists that interviewed Harry in the last week of his life, they agreed with the assessment of psychopathy. But you've got to remember, that's all they had, the research they had to work on at the time. So fast forward to 2013. It was 2013, the 50th anniversary of Harry's execution. Of the Guyon family, only Charles Guyon, Tommy's and Margaret's son, made a comment to the papers. Not surprisingly, he was still very angry about what had happened to all concerned. He said that had Harry Burnet been sectioned when the authorities had the chance, i.e. when he was 18 and tried to kill himself, that his father still would have been alive. He also said that his mother, Margaret, suffered mentally thereafter. Now, I actually used to think that Margaret had killed herself, but apparently no, apparently not. Apparently she succumbed to dementia, because a tour customer actually said that either she herself had worked at the home where Margaret lived or knew somebody that did. And Margaret was actually, I think, quite advanced in years when she died. But of course, it had to carry that with her forever after. And Harry, though, in his last letter to Margaret, had also said that it was rubbish, those that were describing him as insane. He certainly believed he was right in his mind, because if you've got a mind that is damaged, you're going to think your reality is the right one. Harry understood the legality of his crime, but not the morality of it, which suggests to me that he was somewhere in between bipolar, maybe on the autistic spectrum. Certainly his brain was damaged. He had brain trauma, and that has led to his behavioural issues and his violent rages. So, 50 years on, we still don't have an answer. Poor Dr. Lewitt felt that he'd failed Harry thereafter. I don't think Harry should have been hanged. I definitely think he should have either been sent to State Hospital, to Carstairs, because there were two brothers who were incarcerated for murder around about the same time as Harry, the Stuart brothers. One killed a night watchman at Pursley Quarry, beat him to death with a huge iron ladle, and his brother Alexander killed his own wife, who stupidly was having an affair with a local butcher in Middlefield, and Alexander Stewart went to the butcher's shot and stabbed his wife to death. Yet the younger brother ended up in Carstairs because he was found to be completely mentally unfit. Either Alexander was the same or he got life imprisonment, because it's really quite horrific. But these people, again, we can't say they got off, because their sentences as murderers still stood, but the sentence commuted to life imprisonment. Jeannie Donald, the infamous sack murderer from 1934, who had no apparent reason other than jealousy for killing little Helen Priestley, only because she did not speak out in court, did she have her death sentence overturned. In fact, it wasn't overturned. She actually got a royal pardon a whole generation before Harry Burnet. You just think, how is that fair? that a child murderess, who really was a psychopath and didn't seem to have any emotion for what she did, could remain alive, while Harry, who was all over the place emotionally and had been led astray by an older woman who really had not good morals, that he should be executed. And I don't think it's ever been forgotten. At the 50th anniversary as well, we should say in closing that Harry's family, in fact, with some of his siblings that are still alive, they were given his remains. They actually removed Harry's grave from Craigenshiss only because the prison was being closed and being knocked down. Harry's remains were given back to his siblings and they actually cremated him. I suppose that makes best sense because then that's the whole thing. It's finally closure for the family, I would think. And it's actually a unique thing that Harry's remains were given back to his family because a murderer's body is a property of the state, which is why you have five killers' remains, probably dust by now, but five killers' remains that were buried under police headquarters. When it was the East Prison, that's where they were buried. And if you're walking into Queen Street Police Station today, walking over the podium, you're walking over the old prison burial ground. So, literally, there is history beneath your feet. But for today, that's the end of the History Coin podcast.